Welcome to Done and Done. I'm Alicia, your hostess on this podcast journey where we explore and connect the universe of Dominic Dunn. And this week, we do get a little closer to our man Nick as we continue to swim with the swans this week for episode 6 of Feud, Capote versus the Swans. Thank you for joining me today as we are winding it down on the series. And in this episode, there's a lot packed into this one. In today's arc, we are going to talk about a few of the items we saw on screen, some gloves. We're going to talk about Truman's Palm Springs home and an air conditioning repairman too. But the huge hunk of this episode is going to be dedicated to the wild times that happened at Studio 54. We're going to be setting in some real life stories against what episode 6 of the series presented. Before we begin today's journey into disco, I do have some shout-outs to give to a few fine folks out there. Big, huge, colossal thanks to our most recent supporters over at patreon.com/doneanddone. Marie B., Melissa M., Jody, Terry S., Sharon L., Wendy, and Ailsa B. I really appreciate you. Thank you so, so much, new and sustaining supporters. Getting all the main feed episodes early and ad-free, as well as bonus Not Done Yet episodes too. This week over on Patreon for our Not Done Yet bonuses, we did a double drop on those. One about the high cost of being a debutante back in the mid-1950s. It was very big business. And another Not Done Yet this week that dropped, connecting back into Robert Evans' previous past profilee on Done and Done, with his Truman Capote connection, as well as Robert Evans being in the news these days with Sharon Stone spilling the beans about Evans and naming names from the 1993 production of Sliver. All of that and more can be found over on Patreon, but today it is to Bonwit Tellers and Palm Springs to meet a sexy air conditioning man. That's in 68, and then we're going to traverse to the late 1970s and Studio 54 and all of the spider webs in between. Let's investigate. Oh, investigators, this episode, the whole thing, takes place in 1978, and it is certainly the end of an era, but it is not exactly all of the timeline that we will be exploring today. In episode 6 of Feud, we do see a few things. Again, we've covered the in-real-life bits in much of this story that played out in episode 6. Kate Harrington, Jack Dunphy, and the ladies at play here. There are a few other things to mention about this episode and what you saw on screen before we go a little further. These are not necessarily going to be in order, just interesting bits or more to explore. Highlights, really. CZ Guest, again, in this episode, always a loyal friend. Joanne Carson, too. Along with Carol Marcus, Saroy and Mathau, so far not seen, although we will hear about her in episode 7. CZ, Joanne, Carol, lifelong friends to Truman, those ladies. In this particular episode, Babe and CZ cannot get their gloves. And it is tragedy, tragedy, tragedy. It is the passing of an era. This particular scene, taking place for Babe and CZ, was filmed at the Brooks Brothers' former headquarters at 346 Madison Avenue in Manhattan. Where does this take place, though, in the story? Bonwit Teller, the luxury department store which was the height of style for many a fashionable woman in New York City. Bonwit Teller had other stores in many other fashionable cities, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, of course, Palm Beach. Bonwit Teller, like so many other department stores, is long gone now, just like the days of gloves. There's a particular scene in this episode. CZ is shown watching Truman Capote on a talk show. And she's there and she's crying because it goes badly. CZ kind of realizes that Truman is not sober and her heart is breaking for her friend. Although the talk show that CZ is watching is not shown on screen, I'd like to tell you about the event we're seeing dramatized here. Truman Capote will make an absolutely disastrous appearance on the Stanley Siegel Show. The Stanley Siegel Show was a morning show, mind you, that aired in New York City in the late 1970s. A morning show. And Truman Capote is blitzed. Like, very, very far gone. It is a train wreck on screen. I would have cried too, CZ. I have added the link to clips from this disastrous appearance if you would like to garner for yourself. But the thing I want you to know in real time is this morning interview with Truman was done July 18th, 1978. This particular day, July 18th, 1978, is less than 2 weeks after the passing of Babe Paley, who dies July 6th of that same year. Babe passes away the day after her birthday. Of course, Truman Capote was in shambles. Also, in this particular episode, enters the air conditioning man. The thing I want to tell you about this event happened a full 10 years, 1968. We're seeing 1978 in the show, but this sort of confuses the timeline a little bit. Let's explore a little bit more about this relationship as the Circle of Truman Capote describes it with the air conditioning man. Remember, John O'Shea doesn't come into Truman's picture until the early 1970s. This affair would be long before that. Taking a few of these observations from Truman Capote, in which various friends, enemies, acquaintances, and detractors recall his turbulent career. Once again, George Plimpton, excellent, excellent resource. It is in 1968 that Truman buys a home in Palm Springs and will meet an air conditioning repairman. Let's go ahead and set the stage about Truman's Palm Springs home. He is going to stay in this home until Joanne Carson separates from Johnny Carson, who's living in New York. Joanne moves out to California. Truman will sell his Palm Springs home and eventually just move in with Joanne Carson. But there was a time when Truman did have his very own home in Palm Springs. Let's get into that in a little bit more detail, like we did with his UN Plaza apartment. This is from George Christie. I'd visit Truman in Palm Springs when he had his house on Paseo El Mirador, where he'd invite house guests the likes of Lee Radziwill and John Knowles. He would occasionally host lunches and dinners for them. And of course, there were all these mysterious cousins coming and going. I don't know who they were, mysterious cousins coming in from San Diego or somewhere. Truman loved to entertain. He'd have Myrtle, his cook, fix us simple foods, hamburgers and apple pies. He, of course, enjoyed his booze. How vividly I remember that. I gave a luncheon for him at my hideaway in Palm Springs, and he arrived at 12:30 or 1 o'clock. I don't know how many martinis he had before he came, but he stayed until 10 that night. It was one of his non-stop drinking days. Well, what shall I have next? Shall it be champagne? Do you have any cream sherry? A little port? That little house was cleaned out. His capacity was enormous. He loved Palm Springs at that time. Then he was burglarized and began to get upset about that. Burglarized several times. Let's go ahead and hear from dear Princess Lee Radziwill herself. She will say about his home. The house in Palm Springs was very nice, the usual bar with red leather bar stools. I remember Richard Brooks came often with Gene Simmons when Richard was making In Cold Blood. Yet I thought it was the most unreal place I'd ever been in my life. It gave me the creeps, Palm Springs. Nobody had any idea about the desperate things that were happening in Vietnam. It was amazing to find a world that was so out of touch with what was happening. I guess you could slip into it very easily. Truman had very busy afternoons in the spa clubs there. He would go for massages and water treatment. His days were well worked out. That dreadful dog, Maggie, always went slobbering around. I came to stay with him right after New Year's in Palm Springs. My husband, Stas, had given me this beautiful sable coat for Christmas. Truman told me it was very cold there late at night, so I thought this was a perfect place for me and my sable coat. But it didn't get that cold, and I left it in the closet. I left the door open, and Maggie leapt up and got it off the hanger and chewed it to pieces. Truman thought it was hilarious, the funniest thing imaginable, and laughed for days. John Knowles, friend of Truman's and also author of A Separate Piece, I don't know if I've connected that in the investigation yet, John Knowles will say about Truman's Palm Springs home, "It's charming. It was all on one floor, open. The living room was almost square. There were glass doors that slid open, and the patio had a canvas awning. Beyond that, the heated pool and a very large walled lawn and garden, a high wall, big, with real privacy. He had Mabel, a former Cotton Club dancer, who was the housekeeper and cook there. She was down to earth, tough, good for him. She was not going to let any of these guys take her Truman. She told me, I've got connections in this town. Any of these guys start threatening my Truman, one phone call, they're rubbed out. I can take care of anybody. I don't think she told him this. She told me. Every word of it, I believed, too. His pool in Palm Springs was always about 90 degrees. Truman would dog paddle back and forth. He always had this urge to exercise, but he couldn't follow through on it. He came to see me once in a health spa at Pompano Beach, Palm Air Spa. I was exercising like hell and doing all kinds of things to try to get into shape. And succeeding, I think. Truman would do everything passive. He'd have all the massage and all the steam and all the mud, but we couldn't get him to do anything." So, there are a number of other quotes here about Truman's Palm Springs home from Mia Farrow, no less, from Herb Cain. The one quote, I want to get into the air conditioning repair man now. This is from Mary Lazar. Again, wife of Swifty Lazar. We have covered Swifty Lazar, huge in Hollywood, in our investigation. Mary Lazar says, "Nice house. Just a little Palm Springs house, but they'd done the insides very well. A very grand house in a tiny fashion. Small bedrooms, small like Truman. He had all his little things around, his paperweights, little Mexican things, odd paintings that weren't important. He always made a nest for himself. That began a terrible period in Truman's life because that's when he met that awful guy, Danny. Asterisk, not his real name. Who was filling gas tanks at the airport. Kitty Miller said to him, 'And what do you do, young man?' 'All decked out in his leather jacket,' Danny said, 'I gas him up at the airport. I filled Sinatra's tank today.'" Slim Keith, who was absolutely around in 1968, has this to say about Danny. "His means of supporting himself was topping up airplanes, which meant he would go and fill them up with gas at night, and in the day he repaired air conditioners. He was married, had two children, a wife who lived in Chicago." Joan Axelrod has a little bit to say. "The air conditioning man, as he was known. Everybody used to blame the air conditioning man on me because I had found Truman the house. The local air conditioning man came into the house one day to fix the air conditioner. It's as simple as that. He had a wife and a couple of children. I think he was baffled. I think this was his first homosexual experience. And he really picked one, didn't he?" Lenora Hornblow, oh goodness, says this. "The air conditioning man was in the pool. As he came out of the pool, Truman, who had been making us Bloody Marys, leapt to his feet, grabbed a bath towel, ran over, and wrapped him in the most tender and loving way." Swifty Lazar, literary agent, chimes in as well. Oh, Swifty. "This fellow had never worn a white shirt or a tie in his life. He was a hustler. He'd perform or allow himself to be performed on. He didn't care. But he didn't want to stay at home. The day I met him, he looked like a laborer. Then Truman took him over to an Italian shop in Palm Springs, Battaglia, and bought him a blazer with brass buttons and had him fitted for trousers. He was taught to wear a tie and shirt, had his fingernails cleaned. Truman cleaned him up. And then this fellow wanted to go everywhere Truman went, and Truman took him. These stories are about to get just a little bit more outrageous, but all true. I love talking about what Truman's contemporaries had to say. Let me go ahead and bring Slim Keith back into the picture here. She will say about Danny, "Truman was crazy in love with him. I've never seen a man or a woman more in love. He wanted to give the world to Danny. He had his teeth fixed. He gave him a Mercedes. He took him to the tailor, everything. He got him all spiffed up and took him to Europe. The last thing Danny wanted to do was spend 4 sunlit days on the Agnelli yacht. He didn't know the Agnellis. He didn't understand Italian. He didn't like the food. He got sunburned. He hated it." Maria Therese Kane says, "Danny was so visibly out of place and so uncomfortable that I wondered why Truman insisted on bringing him. After he took him on the Agnelli yacht and it didn't go over very well, I asked him why he'd brought him. He said, well, they get to bring whoever they want. Why can't I? He was extremely loyal." John Richardson unpacks that Agnelli trip just a little bit more. This is sad and comical and everything you could want in a story. John Richardson says, "Truman brought him to Europe for one of those very smart Truman summers, which involved staying with the Brandolinis in Venice, going on the Agnelli's yacht for a bit, or the Lowell Guinnesses or whatever. This dim-witted working-class young man hated every minute. There was nobody he could talk to. He felt lost. He had a certain dignity, which is what I think endeared him to Truman. Truman kept trying to sell him on this grand life and impress him with these fine people he was meeting and the fancy experiences he was having. But the boy wouldn't have any of it. He was utterly, utterly miserable. Since the Brandolinis were away and there was nobody else in their palazzo, Truman felt lost and lonely and would bring the friend over every day to lunch at Cipriani's, where Virginia Chambers, an old friend of Truman's, and I were staying. The boy would say, 'All I want is a baked potato. I haven't had a baked potato since I left America. Where can I get a baked potato?' So we asked the Cipriani chef to cook him a baked potato, but he said he didn't have the right potatoes. One day I went to the market and found some big potatoes. So I took them to the chef and explained that they were to be cooked in their jackets. We sat down to lunch in a state of great excitement. With a huge flourish, the silver dishes arrived, and there were the inevitable sautéed potatoes. The chef just couldn't believe that you cooked potatoes in their jackets. The boy was so crestfallen, so dismayed about this, that he sort of lapsed back into total gloom. If he had gotten his baked potatoes, I think he might have hated Venice a bit less." Let's go ahead and hear from a swan of Truman's who has been sadly left out of few. This is from Marella Agnelli. "The last summer, Truman and I saw each other. We were staying in a beautiful house in Spain that belonged to the Fierros, remote, on this sort of fjord. Lee Radziwill was there. We had about 8 or 10 or 12 friends, lots of children. Truman called me, 'Can I bring a friend?' I didn't like the idea because in a way I was jealous of his friendship and I didn't want to share it with anybody. So I said, 'Well, Truman, let's see. I'm afraid I don't have 2 rooms.' He said in this tiny voice, 'It doesn't matter. We can sleep in the same room.' So I had no choice. He came with Danny. The following winter, I remember walking with him in this beautiful pine forest and asking, 'Tell me, Truman, what is the point of Danny?' He said, 'You know, it happened so suddenly. In Palm Springs, something went wrong with his air conditioner, so he called somebody to repair it. He told me, I heard this southern voice, and that suddenly brought me back to my childhood. I ran into the room and I saw Danny. I never understood it. He was not even very good looking, certainly not very interesting. Everybody tried to do their best with him, but nothing moved. Danny was probably bored to tears too. He found himself out of his world completely. He stayed a long time, about 10 days. Two more little bits about Danny here before we wrap this section up. John Richardson says, he, Truman, was obsessed with this boy, telling us all the time that the boy was heterosexual. Truman said that all the loves of his life had basically been heterosexual. I didn't like to say that the mere fact of a boy going to bed with him made him no longer heterosexual. I mean, there had to be a sort of flaw in their heterosexuality. Vanity prevented Truman from understanding my point. It was very important for this little dwarf monster to feel capable of seducing straight men away from women. It was a feather in his cap. In this particular case, anybody could have seduced this poor boy. He was so will-less. Getting him into bed didn't prove anything. Not that I think there was a great deal of sex. Truman was more obsessed with having this wretched boy as a trophy, a straight trophy. He was Truman's prey, his victim. They went off to Denmark or somewhere. On the plane from wherever it was to London to stay with Lee Radziwill, the boy broke the news to Truman that he just couldn't stand it anymore and he was leaving him. And that triggered, I think, one of Truman's big collapses. Closing this one out with a quote from Slim Keith about Danny and the breakup. He, Truman, was devastated. I've never seen anyone in such a condition. You'd look at him and he'd cry. You'd say, True, it's gonna be all right. Believe me, I've been to this fire. I know it's going to be all right. But I love him so much. Ah, Danny, the air conditioning repair man. Again, that whole entire scene happened in the late 60s, way before John O'Shea, and I do think it signifies sort of a break for Truman. That was a real heartbreak. Truman Capote, evidence through time, terrible taste in men, with the exception of that Jack Dunphy. Jack was mostly an angel for Truman Capote, as much as Truman did not appreciate it. Now is a terrific time to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to move our timeline ahead to the wild 1970s to go boogie it up at Studio 54. Back in a moment. Oh my, the 70s. In this episode, we do see CZ Guest and Truman Capote boogieing it up at Studio 54. It was a real hotspot for Truman Capote. So many stories to tell about Studio 54 and the brief period of time in which it was a thing. It wasn't a thing for all that long, friends. It hits at the right moment. Disco hotspot of the United States, in the right city. Studio 54 holds such a large piece of our collective imagination from the picture of the 1970s. But Studio 54 was only open 33 months. Tip to toe, that's it. From April of 1977 to January 1980. That's it. Very tiny piece of time. But it was the right place at the right time. Studio 54 was the it place, landing in the time of every moment that's happening culturally. We are in the time between the pill and women embracing sexual freedom, long before AIDS had been given a name. Studio 54 was located at 254 West 54th Street between 8th Avenue and Broadway. This is in Midtown Manhattan. The building that Studio 54 was housed in was originally an opera house. CBS will use that building as a studio for both radio and television beginning in 1942. What was filmed in the Studio 54 location? Oh, one of my favorites. What's My Line? The $64,000 Question, I've Got a Secret, and Captain Kangaroo. Those would be our main programming features. Can't forget about the soap opera Love of Life that was filmed in the building as well. CBS is going to move its operation over to the Ed Sullivan Theater as well as the CBS Broadcast Center in 1976, leaving just the year before Studio 54 is to open a ton of old sets and stuff. So much stuff. All of these old sets will become part of a new story within Studio 54 in this soon-to-be Xanadu of hedonism and debauchery and pleasure and so many drugs. So let's go ahead and set Studio 54 up a little bit here before we talk about Truman playing there. It is in 1977 that friends Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager have this idea. And their idea is pretty much to make a pile of money. Steve is the ringleader. He's the razzle-dazzle guy. He is super gay. He loves his position of Napoleon at the door. He loves ruling over his Studio 54 club. Steve Rubell and the doorman Mark are going to choose every night who gets into the spot and who does not. Steve Rubell is a master of hosting a party, and every night it is a new one. He blends it all. There's a mix of celebrities, of regular people, gay kids, drag queens, women. Andy Warhol is a super regular party goer at the club. Warhol will say about Studio 54 that it was a dictatorship at the door and a democracy inside. There was no A-list, B-list, or C-list. Everyone was a star. Speaking of Andy Warhol, my Patreon folks, stay tuned for Not Done Yet this week. I have a little bit coming on the relationship between Andy Warhol and Truman Capote, Truman writing for Andy's interview magazine, Andy being Truman's poster on the wall, coming to New York in the late 1940s, as well as connecting that back through Truman's poster on the wall of Cecil Beaton. Stay tuned on Not Done Yet on Patreon for that to drop after this main feed episode. Okay, that's Steve Rubell. He's the coordinator. He's the show guy. Ian Schrager, the other partner, is a lawyer. He's a pretty savvy accountant. He will keep meticulous records of the operation at Studio 54, which would be fantastic if there was just one set of books, but there are two sets of books. And the plan that Ian and Steve had was always, again, to make a pile of money. So here with their two books idea, they are skimming money off the top as well. They open to make a lot of tax-free money and have a good time, and, well, they're doing it. But here's how the grift works. At midnight, everything changes over. All of the bar tills, all of the money, everything gets collected like clockwork at midnight. What is taken in, money-wise, through midnight is what's reported in record book number one. What is collected after midnight to closing time of Studio 54 is all juice, all extra cash, all extra profit. So perhaps you've heard of the velvet rope at Studio 54. That is where you're waiting to be cool enough, high energy enough to have the right look to get in the door. There's no set criteria for getting in. There aren't really any rules. People are trying to game the system. How cool do I need to be to actually get in? But Steve Rubell, making his party out every night, he's looking for a balance of regular people and celebrities. People are scoping this out. It is the place to see and be seen, but only if you can get in the door. Now, if you're lucky enough to get in the door, What happens next? The next place passing the velvet rope that you're going to see is what Myrna, the assistant for Steve Rubell for a long time, calls the Corridor of Joy. Here there's a chandelier and screaming when you got in, and there's a hallway and you can hear the music. And this Corridor of Joy kind of gets you pumped up, getting ready. So when you turn the corner, whoa, Studio 54 is a theater. It was used for filming for CBS. There's a huge space for dancing. There's a balcony upstairs that is used for some illicit sexual activities. There are also back rooms, which become VIP rooms. There's an incredibly sticky, sticky basement, which is the coolest hangout. We're going to talk about that a little bit in just a few more moments. And when I say coolest hangout, I don't mean because of the atmosphere. It's disgusting. There are gross mattresses and old sets and low ceilings and exposed pipes, but it's where all the cool kids hang out. You can only get into the grody basement through these secret doors behind the bar. It was kind of a special invite thing. Let me tell you about how exclusive Studio 54 is. There is also, right, oh gosh, so many passageways. There's a total underground market at the time of secret maps that will get you from somewhere to somewhere in the bowels of the city. Maybe through the subway, some such nonsense. People are so desperate to get into Studio 54 that there's actually a man found in one of the vents who tried to sneak in and sadly, unfortunately, died within that vent. This man was not discovered until he began to smell, and the staff was like, whoa, something's really wrong. They will find this poor gentleman in his tuxedo, trying to break into the club. Now, part of the problem was sneaking in through the vents or the areas supporting Studio 54 is that Studio 54 are packing their illegally gained cash and drugs, stuffing them into the vents, also into closets, into their car trunks as well. Into Steve Rubell's puffy coat. I think he invents the puffy coat thing. There's always money and drugs that Steve has just handing out double-fisted. Andy Warhol is always up in Steve's business because Andy gets paid. Andy comes in and plays with the money. Steve Rubell's like, hey, take $10,000. Have a good time, buddy. Oh, goodness. This place. So, little bit more backstory on Studio 54. Its opening night was April 26th, 1977. And the hype machine has been spinning. Steve Rubell, genius. He knows how to get people in his club. All through the first year of Studio 54, they are operating on a daily liquor license. It has to be renewed every single day. There's no permanent license to serve liquor. So, a little bit of a problem, a little bit of a complication. One day, though, they will not be able to get their daily license renewed, and so the bar goes to selling juice only, but also there's cocaine and quaaludes. No one's necessarily coming to Studio 54 for the excellent cocktails. On opening night, April 26, 1977, the very first person in the door, former President Donald Trump. He and Ivana and some friends had just finished up dinner at Elaine's, and of course Donald Trump wants to be at the coolest place. He's the first person in line. He gets in. He's not impressed. But then Studio 54 begins to fill up. Who comes in next? Cher and Margot Hemingway. Cher is the first one to make it to the dance floor. Margot Hemingway joins her. Photos of this encounter will lead headlines in the papers the next day. Holy cats, here comes Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. They're filming The Wiz at this time. Look around the corner, there's baby Brooke Shields being escorted by Robin Leach. Like you can't make it up. Then there are the drag queens and the gay kids and the stockbrokers, and you add them all together and whoosh, it's a party. Rumors are that Frank Sinatra is circling around the block in a limousine, trying to figure out how to get in. Henry Winkler, the Fonz, is turned away at the door. So is Warren Beatty. And now, there are hundreds of people on opening night outside, really wanting to get in the club that is already filled to the rafters. Studio 54 has been open an hour, and there are 1,000 people inside and 1,000 people outside. And super helpfully, there's a doctor outside waiting to get in the club who's just brought with him a whole box of Quaaludes. So he starts handing them out to the people waiting outside around him, and soon enough, there's a legitimate orgy happening on the sidewalk outside of Studio 54. Needless to say, opening night, Studio 54 has arrived and is now going to be the it place. Another day of legend is going to happen in Studio 54 the second week the place is in business. Halston, our famous designer, and his bosom friend, Bianca Jagger. It's her birthday on May the 3rd, and Bianca, this particular year, will be 32, but the press will say it's her 30th birthday. She shaves off a few years. Anyway, the day after the opening, Halston calls Steve Rubell, and he's like, "Hey, Steve, I would love to host Bianca's birthday party there next week." And Steve Rubell says, "Of course, me, club, Sue, club," and hangs up. And Steve Rubell promptly says, "We're going to need a horse." Apparently, Bianca Jagger is an equestrian, which is how the infamous photo of her on the horse is pushed around the world in whatever viral photos meant in 1977. Bianca Jagger does not ride the horse to Studio 54, but Steve Rubell helpfully had that horse on the ready for the photo opportunity. Bianca Jagger later will say she regrets that move. Maybe she should regret maybe making Studio 54 her second home, as her husband, Mick Jagger, will meet Jerry Hall, his soon-to-be wife, at Studio 54, where they begin, Mick and Jerry do, their love affair. The list of celebrities who are coming to Studio 54 is just amazing. Everyone. If you want to go down a fun rabbit hole, the photos from the 33 months Studio 54 is open are the proof. Ginger Rogers parties there. Dolly Parton, too, books a after party, and Steve Rubell hangs up and says, "Well, we need farm animals." Dolly wasn't too amused about the farm animal part. Fellini will provide costumes for guests one night at a particular costumed event. Every night it is a party at Studio 54. There's Elton John chatting it up with Divine. There's Liza Minnelli and Andy Warhol. Oh, there's Bruce Springsteen and Elizabeth Taylor. And there's Linda Ronstadt and Margaret Trudeau chatting it up with Ryan O'Neill. Like, you just can't make it up. Truman Capote did spend an inordinate amount of time at Studio 54. We have a number of stories from his friends and contemporaries about Truman and Studio 54. We're going to take a quick break and come back to reveal those stories from friends and Truman himself, as well as talk about the end of Studio 54. See you on the flip. Once Truman was in 1975 dumped by his swans, he certainly finds some different ways to amuse himself. One of those ways was absolutely being a poster boy for Studio 54. Have a few recollections about Truman and Studio 54 from that time, again from George Plimpton's book. The first is from Bob Colicello. Studio 54 opened in April 1977. The first big party was May, but it really didn't get clicking with everybody until the fall, because they didn't have a liquor license that first summer. Then Truman went quite a lot. He used to call it Cinquenta Quattro. In Italian. He liked to go up to the disco booth. I think Steve Rubell, the co-owner, showed him how to work the lights. He loved being up there. Anthony Hayden Guest, a writer, says about Studio 54, "Studio 54 only had 18 months, basically, of white intensity. Nobody expected anything like it. The Daily News on the morning of the opening of the club had a derisive little item captioned, "Studio 54, where are you?" poking fun at it because there were too many bad discos then. It is quite wrong to think of Studio 54 as a place where people went to look at celebrities. It wasn't a way where celebrities went to look at people. Ian Schrager, the co-owner with Rubel, told their publicist, a nice New Yorker type, when they were really riding high, "Ed, put up a chart with 1,000 days and cross off a day every day. That's all anything lasts in New York, 1,000 days. It's not always true, but Studio 54 wasn't meant to last. Nonetheless, it had an enormous effect. When I first came to New York, in my mind, the social order here was still ruled by people with names like Auchincloss and Winthrop. Studio 54 changed all that, just as London in the early 60s changed with clubs like the Ad Lib. Suddenly, David Bailey and Mick Jagger were at least as chic as the Duke of Devonshire. That's what happened with Studio 54. Suddenly, Calvin Klein was a major social force." This is from Kate Harrington, John O'Shea's daughter. "We went to Studio 54 about 10 times. It was really exciting. I never drank or anything back then, so I was probably the only person there sober. I remember it vividly, crystal clear. It was very glamorous to me at the time. It was like going to another planet, another world, because it was so dark and strange. When Truman would come, it was like Moses. The seas would part and they'd wave him in. He'd come in that hallway that was black with the spotlighted calla lilies, and then all the fans. Hi, Truman. The men running around in diapers, the cocktail waiters." William Avery, publicist, says this, "Many of the bartenders and busboys were half gay. If they weren't, they were receptive to advances. It was like a maze, like an English garden. Well, more like a rabbit warren. I was always invited to the back of the scrim up on the stage. When the scrim dropped, that was the VIP section where everybody came through the back door on 53rd Street. The back of the scrim people kept their clothes on. Downstairs in the basement, people took their clothes off. Balcony people certainly took their clothes off too. Dangerous place. At the second floor bar, I knew the bartender, so he gave me free drinks. Someone offered me a cigarette once, which was laced with PCP. I was up and down the stairs for about 4 hours, just racing, looking at people, talking to people. I'm sure not making much sense, being very convivial and chatting. One night I fell asleep in my tuxedo. I had a gold watch on and a ring. At 7 o'clock in the morning, somebody was vacuuming the floor. I got up and I left. Nobody had taken my wallet or anything. I was just lying there like a mummy." From Anthony Hayden Guest, "The original VIP room at Studio 54 was off the co-owner Steve Rubel's office upstairs, first floor, but that simply became too obvious, going in and out up there, so people went down to the basement. Dingy, like all basements, hideous, lots of little cubicles, diseased-looking banquettes, a lot of disused props, all these odd children's toys. I remember mattresses everywhere where people like Truman would go." All right, going down. Let's get down to the basement. Bob Colicello. "It was like any big basement. It had oil burners and lots of pipes and all these storerooms, which basically were cyclone-fenced cages. It had a bathroom somewhere. There would be puddles from where the pipes were leaking. It had cement floors. It was not at all attractive. Steve would set up one cyclone-fenced cage as the room where he'd throw some cushions on the floor. And the next week, it would be at the other end of the basement. You always had to figure out where it was. You'd go down through the staircase behind the kitchen. It was mostly the Halston and the Andy Warhol group. Mainly, we'd go down there and sit around, and a busboy would bring us a bottle of vodka. People would take Coke there if they didn't want to do it in front of people upstairs, where the bathrooms were always too crowded. You'd sit there under the dance floor, so there would be this bump, bump, bump of people dancing and the music right overhead. One of the great nights I remember in the basement was when Yves Saint Laurent launched his opium perfume with a big party downtown in South Street Seaport. Then we all went up to Studio 54. I remember sitting in the basement with Truman and Catherine Guinness's cousin, Hugo Guinness, who had just come in from London. He was very young, 18 years old, and we were using him as our waiter. He would go back and forth and get Truman and me more vodkas. Barbara Allen was sitting with us. Halston was there. Marina Shiano arrived with Yves Saint Laurent. We all stood up to greet them, and Halston and Yves kissed each other. Like, this big moment. They were big rivals. One was the king of American fashion. The other was the king of French couture. Truman said, "You have just witnessed one of the greatest moments in the history of fashion. If you care about the history of fashion, that is." Anthony Hayden Guest will continue about the basement. Jack Martin told me he was having a drink with Steve Rubell. They went down to the basement. Steve suddenly said, "That's the princess, the princess." Some Eurotrash princess had just been taken down to the basement by her own request, handcuffed to a water pipe, and fucked by one of the barmen, who then thought, "My God, I've got to get back to the bar," and forgot about the handcuffs and had left her down there. Barbara Allen has this to say, "It was so ugly, that room, the VIP room at Studio 54. The basement, a cage in the basement where you'd put your storage. There were all sorts of people from Halston, Yves Saint Laurent, all the film and rock stars. I know people who used to fall asleep and wake up the next morning and think, where am I?" There were always jokes about that. You'd just walk over them. Really strange. I'll never forget this cage, just sitting around there on boxes. It was interesting to be somewhere that was secret. Because of the dancing and all the music, all you heard was dun, dun, dun. You know that horrible beat of the songs, just bang, bang, bang. And if you had a headache, you couldn't possibly be down there. Just this vibration you'd get. There was one long corridor you went through. I can hardly remember. And there was another office down at the end. They called it an office. It was an office. Actually, they had a telephone. In this labyrinth, if you walked around, you'd run into friends. It wasn't exactly the cleanest place in the world. Yes, there were drugs, but you didn't always see them. Everyone that experienced that time has some sort of secret. We knew we were having the time of our lives. We were loving it. We knew it was an extraordinary time, and we knew it wouldn't last. Once I saw Truman when he came in pajamas. What do you call those moo-moo things? It was a black caftan. You could get away with that there. Those times were kind of a blur for everybody. But everyone looked beautiful, if a little debauched. Nan Kempner, infamous New York socialite and friend of Dominic Dunn's, has this to say. "I used to love Studio 54. I adored it. Because it took you right out of yourself. Fantasy land. I always went with friends. I never went all by myself. We'd go in a gang, and they were very nice to us. We'd get helped into that roped-in part. You felt very special when you went there. I loved the dancing. I used to dance with all sizes, shapes, forms, colors, and I'd come home absolutely limp. It was divine. I'll never forget the night I was standing at the bar, and Halston was handed a pill, sort of a triangular-shaped pill. I said, 'What's the matter? Do you have a headache?' He looked at me as if I was crazy, and he said, 'It's a Quaalude.' I had to ask three people what a Quaalude was. I'm rather moronic. I went downstairs to where everybody was either shooting, poking, pushing, or snorting. It was fabulous. I just loved watching all this stuff go on. It was a whole way of life, and it was very interesting. There was a place called the Tunnel. I went down there one night, and some friend of mine who was a designer said to me, 'You're not going up there, up some circular stairs or something.' Apparently, it was a gangbang going on at all times, and he said, 'No way are you going up there.' They turned me around and walked me out the door. I felt I was missing something, a happening. It's always been the story of my life, as you know. I don't want to miss anything. Nowadays, the big change has been age, as far as I'm concerned. Now I can't wait to slide into the sheets. Isn't that awful? Isn't that embarrassing? I'm sure that if somebody were to take me to a wonderful place like Studio 54, I'd be all hell-bent to go. But the places don't exist anymore. Those that are still around are very boring, and I'm too old to sit and talk about nothing in the wee hours of the morning over loud music. I got two more excellent quotes from contemporaries of Truman's before we get to what Truman has to say about Studio 54. This one comes from Liz Smith, columnist extraordinaire, friend of Dominic Dunn's. I always say to people, I'm sure glad I wasn't hip enough or attractive enough or young enough to be invited to the downstairs room at Studio 54, because everybody who ever went there is dead. Lots of drugs and needles. Truman was really in the thick of it. One night, John Berendt, later to write the bestseller Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and I went out with Truman and met first at his apartment in the UN Plaza. Truman said, I'm going to show you something so great that you won't even believe it. He went out of the room and came in with a big glass of cocaine. Our mouths kind of flapped open because I had never seen so much cocaine. I mean, it had to be $10,000 worth. It was actually more than a big glass. It was in a bowl. We weren't going to partake because even if I had wanted to, I wouldn't have done that with Truman. I didn't trust him. I knew it would become an amusing story. Then he said suddenly, no, I'm not going to give you any. You're not good enough. Neither one of you is good enough. And with that, he went out of the room with the bowl, and John called after him jokingly, well, do you suppose we can have a marijuana cigarette? Yanni Winner, publisher of Rolling Stone, has this to say. If they didn't know Truman by sight, they'd know him as soon as he opened his mouth and uttered a word. All the doors opened for him. People coming for autographs. Kind of a strange fan club he had. But the funniest was seeing him in the gay discos. In the gay world, he was kind of a hero because he was one of the first public homosexuals. So they just loved and adored him. You'd go into a gay disco with Truman and you got seated at the number one table right on the dance floor. Everybody coming over and asking Truman to dance. Can you imagine those guys asking Truman to dance? There are a number of other stories in this volume about Truman and other gay bars in New York City at the time, but it is Studio 54 that is our focus today. I do have one other fun bit here. What does Truman have to say about Studio 54? In 1979, Truman, a little bit sobered up, has an hour-long interview with David Susskind. And the layers of this interview are pretty incredible. I'm going to pull one bit of it out for this episode. We will be hearing more about this particular interview and some Truman hot takes in the next few weeks. But I'm pulling this one in about Studio 54 straight from the mouth of Truman Capote within the 33 months of Studio 54's heyday. This was, again, this interview 1979, so it would have been in the middle of its heyday. This is minutes 5 to 10 within this David Susskind interview. I have posted that whole link over in show notes as well on the Dunn & Dunn website, where all sources can always be found. Here, David Susskind asks Truman, why do you go to Studio 54 and so often? What's the appeal? Truman says, because I like it. David Susskind, the noise, the din? Truman, no, I'll tell you quite seriously why I like Studio 54. It's kind of a total amalgamation of all sorts of things. I like nightclubs, period. I always have. I've been going to them since I was 15, 14 years old. You see, I'm from New Orleans, which is a big nightclub town, and I was brought up there and in Alabama, but my family's house was right in the quarter, and so, I don't know. I've spent a lot of times in cafes and nightclubs and always have. I don't know. When I was first in New York, I was working at the New Yorker magazine. I used to go almost every day. I was about 17 years old then. I used to go every day to have lunch at the Stork Club with Una O'Neill and Carol Marcus, she was then. Susskind lends in, Saroyan. Then she became Saroyan, and David chimes in to help Truman on this one, saying, but you wanted to be seen. And Truman responds, no, they were just friends of mine. We used to go up there to have lunch every day. It was just a thing I liked. The conversation then goes to, would you have gone to another restaurant or the Waldorf? Truman responds, no, but I liked the thing. Yes, of course I would have gone there or anything. I like things like that too. I like automats. I was mad about automats. I still go to the automat on 42nd Street and, what is it, 3rd Avenue? I've never seen you in an automat, Susskind says. Truman responds, well, perhaps you've never been in one, but I like to go to them. I go to all kinds of places, but still, you're getting off the point. This is the irony here, I think, that Truman Capote bringing it back to the subject at hand, which is Studio 54. Truman continues, I think that Studio 54 is one of the most interesting nightclubs I've ever been in my life, anywhere in the world, and I've lived everywhere in the world. I've lived everywhere from Moscow to Hong Kong, Los Angeles, New York, Venice, Rome. Never has there been a nightclub as amusing as Studio 54. Susskind, but aren't people there absurd in their dress, in their attitude? And isn't there a lot of spaced out folks stretched out there? Some of the most prominent people? Truman responds, well, maybe a little stretched out just from the fatigue of dancing. David, come on, Truman. Truman, come on, David. Where's your sense of humor? Get with it. 54 is a very amusing, very fun place. What's nice about it is that I think it's one of the healthiest places I've ever seen. People do very little drinking there, and very little drugging, too, for that matter. They're having a really good... Truman. Now, I ought to know whereof I speak. Truman, there is sniffing of various stuff going on there. They are. Truman says, well, will you tell me any nightclub in the entire United States or Canada or Europe where people aren't sniffing or smoking something? But nobody's out there nodding with heroin. It's just a bunch of people having a good time. And they're really having a good time. All they're doing is dancing and laughing and having a good time. I don't understand this whole phobia about Studio 54. I have no phobia, Susskind says. Truman responds, I think it's just pure envy. I really mean that. I think people are just so envious of any kind of success whatsoever. Studio 54 is a success, so therefore, it's got to be knocked all the time. David says, Truman, I have seen you on one of those lovely banquets with your star performer friends and your creative designing associates, and you're all somewhere else. I said, hello, Truman, and you sort of giggled. Truman says, you saw me personally with your very own eyes? Susskind, of course I saw you with my own eyes. Yes, these eyes. And I even said, my God, can that be Truman? And I put my glasses on. Truman, well, that's interesting. When was it? Susskind, oh, I don't know. It was a night that one of these people was having a party and you were feeling no pain. And it was a gay wild jamboree and you were singing. You remember singing? Truman, I sing a lot. Well, I don't know, but I don't. David then says, would you recommend it to your sister? Truman responds, sure, I'd recommend it to anybody. I think it's one of the most innocent, beguiling places I've ever seen. It's everything the way it ought to be. It's very democratic. It's all kinds of colors, all kinds of sizes. Boys and boys together, girls and girls together, girls and boys together. Poor people, rich people, taxi drivers, anything you want. It's all mixed up together. That's what I like about it. I mean, the old-style nightclubs like El Morocco, the Stork Club. Truman's unfolding this point here. Those were for rich people. Everybody was out in those clubs to have a good time, but they were for rich people. Studio 54, Truman's making the point here. Studio 54 is for perfectly ordinary people. And David Susskind says, Truman, your passion for poor people is a new hobby. What are you talking about? And Truman says, I've always liked all kinds of people. And Susskind says, Truman, you're always on people's yachts and at their great mansions on Long Island. You're in the Greek islands cruising. You're at the thing in Spain with the Pamplona bull runs. So what? Truman says, that's just another thing to do, isn't it? I don't see what that's got to do with whether you like people or don't. I like all kinds of people. I like rich people because they aren't always trying to borrow something from me. Susskind asks, I love this. Are you trying to borrow something from them? Truman responds, no. I give a great deal, more than they give. Susskind asks, well, what do you give in return for 3 weeks on a super yacht? Truman responds, a lot of interesting conversation. David, how expensive is it? How expensive is what? You know, room and board and visit to gambling casinos in the Aegean Sea. I mean, you've been. Truman says, I like to travel. If I'm going to travel, I'd rather travel on a very beautiful yacht. Who wouldn't? Susskind, right, well, where's the passion for the poor and those little folks coming into Studio 54? Truman, I pick them up on the street and take them to Studio 54 so they can have a good time. Susskind, God, you're a humanitarian. I never thought of you that way. Truman responds, actually, I'm a great humanitarian. And then they go to a break. Goodness. Truman can't get enough of Studio 54. Again, it only lasts 33 months in its heyday. Let's go ahead and talk about how it ends up only lasting 33 months. Within Studio 54's popularity, celebrities, front page, it is the melting pot of every club scene ever. Steve Rubell gets a little sassy, and he's interviewed, and he says in that interview that Studio 54 made $7 million last year, and only the mafia makes more money. And this little quote gets the feds really interested, leading to another big day in the history of Studio 54. That day is December 15th, 1978. This is the day of the raid. And this morning, 30 federal agents bang in the place. We've talked about it all before. They find bags of money, the first set of books, the second set of books, drugs stuffed in vents and closets, so many drugs. In a typical skimming scheme, you're going to take 2%, just a little. Like, you're not going to take a lot, enough to have it be easily forgiven. Nobody's going to notice 2%. That is not what Ian and Steve are doing. They are skimming 80%. They are also tracking in their books the amount of money they're making from cocaine sales. They call them party favors. I mean, it's a grift, it's a graft. Needless to say, the day of the raid, Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager are arrested. They are arrested for the skimming, they are arrested for tax evasion, and they are arrested for the drugs. They both plead guilty. Both Steve and Ian are sentenced to 3.5 years in 1980. No fear, though. They will. Studio 54 goes out with a pretty big party. The party to end all parties. This happens February 2nd and 3rd, 1980, before they began their jail sentences. Here's the thing. Steve and Ian are only going to spend about a year in jail apiece, as their lawyer, pretty famous one, Roy Cohn, is going to make some helpful things happen with all of his lying lies. Roy Cohn gets Steve and Ian to turn in like four other nightclubs that are all running the same sort of skimming scheme. Cohn gets their sentence lessened. And then, woo, we get into a little bit of complication with the Jimmy Carter administration. This is going to concern one of his staff and hometown boy here in Atlanta for me, Hamilton Jordan. This is the scandal that almost topples a presidency. Hamilton Jordan, at the time, there's a lot of rumors going around that Hamilton Jordan was doing the coke, doing all the cocaine in the dingy basement of Studio 54. The rumor gets around, and certainly the half of the side who doesn't really like Jimmy Carter or his administration are like, we absolutely need to investigate this. What a great way to burn Jimmy Carter. Hamilton Jordan, to be fair, was one of the lightning rods in Carter's administration. Rumors are out. Magazines are reporting on this. How does Carter get the information that Hamilton Jordan is about to be investigated, and how does this all go down? Amid all the festivities aboard the Delta Queen, there came an ominous phone call for President Carter at about 8:15 last Thursday night. It was the new Attorney General, Benjamin Civiletti. He regretfully told the president a stunning piece of news. He had just ordered the FBI to undertake a preliminary investigation of Carter's two closest White House aides, Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan and Press Secretary Jody Powell. The reason: an allegation that Jordan had snorted cocaine during a visit to New York City's Studio 54, a celebrated disco club. The first version of the story said in April 1978, and that Powell had been with him at the time. Y'all, the story gets reported on 2020, no less. On 2020, 28-year-old drug dealer John Conahan, known as Johnny C., said that he had been at Studio 54 on the night of Mr. Jordan's reported visit and that he had remembered turning a few people on with cocaine in a basement area. He said he was not introduced to Mr. Jordan, but had been told by other people that he was one of those who had been turned on. Billy C. told the interviewer that he wasn't really 100% sure that he could identify Mr. Jordan as having been involved in the illegal incident. So what happens? The FBI interrogates Jody Powell, who was on board the Mississippi Riverboat with the president. And then the FBI then spoke to Hamilton Jordan in D.C. Both men deny the allegation. Hamilton Jordan admits that he did go to Studio 54 for about an hour once, but he did not use drugs. At the time, Studio 54's owners were facing criminal charges for tax evasion, obstruction of justice, and conspiracy charges. Rubel had hired notorious lawyer Roy M. Cohn, who had heard that Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell had visited the club. Cohn, who was not above making false claims, recorded a statement from the dealer, Johnny C., who had apparently provided the alleged drugs, and then Roy Cohn brings that tape to the FBI. Cohn tells the FBI that Steve Rubel would testify against Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell only in exchange for immunity for himself. Hamilton Jordan was a pretty powerful figure at the time and also had a little bit of a reputation himself as a party-goer. The story remains the same. Not much has changed since the late 1970s. There was a special prosecutor appointed to the case, but no charges were ever filed as the investigation did not substantiate any of Steve Rubel's claims. Hamilton Jordan would later write, "I remember the celebration in my office in the White House on the afternoon that independent counsel Arthur Christie announced that the grand jury had voted 24-0 against bringing an indictment against me." Christie, who obviously had figured out the scam that Roy Cohn had almost pulled off, announced that there was no serious evidence against me and told a few key press people on background that I had been set up by Roy Cohn and his friends. Oh, the 70s, so shady. So how do we get out of this mess? Steve and Ian are eventually released from the slammer. Steve Rubel will pass away in 1989 from AIDS-related complications. Ian Schrager, he's doing just fine. He has opened a number of boutique hotels in the last years. He is enjoying life with Studio 54 celebration anniversaries and such. I think he released a book. Ian Schrager is definitely setting the record straight about Studio 54 and what he claims to be his part in it, which is a little bit easier if your business partner and friend has passed. One other thing, Ian Schrager was pardoned by President Obama for those criminal charges before Obama left office. Studio 54, y'all, this place captured a moment in time. Again, 33 months, not even 3 years it was open, but it captured the culture, the imagination, and I doubt we are likely to see something like that again. Studio 54 stories just keep on giving. Gonna go ahead and end this one. We've gone a really long time today. There is one more bit within episode 6 of Feud, which I think is the most interesting bit. Again, within the series, you have to suspend disbelief and a little bit of knowledge. The story isn't exactly told correctly here. But in episode 6, there's a run-in with dear Princess Leah Radziwill, who is so mad at Truman Capote for her own reasons. We're seeing this in 78, but Lee has been mad at Truman since 1968 for reasons that will come into play and be expounded when her stepbrother, Gore Vidal, sues Truman Capote and Lee helps Gore do the thing. That is the story, the lifelong feud between Truman Capote and Gore Vidal that we are going to be exploring on our next week's episode of Done and Done. These two writers really do have a lot of bad blood between them. They have been in a feud since 1948 or so, and it is trashily wonderful. I do hope you tune in for the next Done and Done, where we cover tip to toe that infamous feud. In the meantime, between now and that episode, don't forget I will be dropping a Not Done Yet bonus out on Patreon. Andy Warhol, Cecil Beaton, so much good stuff. Always something happening over there. If you are looking to get more out of your Done and Done journey, patreon.com/doneanddone is the place to go to find out more information about how you can get early and ad-free episodes and those bonus episodes as well. If you liked this particular trashy story, don't forget you can always find me and my trashy counterpart, Stacy, over on Trashy Divorces and Trashy Royals as well. Thank you, thank you, thank you, investigators, once again for tuning in, spending your time with me today. Huge thanks for your support in all the ways. And until we meet again, stay curious and keep on investigating. Big love, everybody. Bye. Thanks for listening to the Done and Done podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at doneanddone@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Done and Done Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.doneanddone.com. See you next week, friends.